NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. The president of Libya says he has no doubt the deadly attack on the U.S. embassy there on the 9/11 anniversary was pre-planned. NBC's Ayman Moyadeen is in Benghazi.
He says that there were foreign elements involved and suggesting that perhaps al-Qaeda-inspired militants may have played a role in trying to revenge the killing of a senior al-Qaeda member.
Closer to home, FBI agents have arrested a man they say planned to set off a car bomb outside a bar in downtown Chicago.
Planned, investigators say in a detailed criminal complaint, by 18-year-old Adele Daoud, an American teen who lives in Hillside just outside Chicago.
That's NBC's Michelle Franzen reporting. The State Department is taking precautions against continuing protests against an anti-Islam film produced in the U.S. Washington has ordered the departure of all family members and non-essential U.S. personnel from posts in Sudan and Tunisia. This is NBC News Radio. It all comes down to a vote of their delegates this afternoon for 25,000 striking Chicago teachers. If the delegates like what they hear about weekend negotiations, the city's 350,000 public school students could return to class tomorrow. Negotiations frosted over as the NHL closes for business.
A failure to come to terms in a new labor deal, the National Hockey League has locked out its players. This marks the third major pro sport to impose a work stoppage in the last 18 months behind the NFL and NBA. It's also the fourth shutdown for the NHL since 1992. The key issue, cold, hard cash, how to split a $3.3 billion pot of revenue. Barbara Cusack, NBC News Radio.
Police have made a number of arrests during a New York City demonstration marking the first anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement. The official anniversary date is Monday. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
This is Hulk Hogan. Are you a man over 40 who's noticed less energy? Are you losing muscle? Do you have less drive in your romantic life than you once had? Hey, this happens to most guys with age. It even started happening to me. Then I heard about Ageless Male, an all-natural supplement for men. Ageless Male helps boost your testosterone levels, naturally and safely. Plus, it has ingredients shown to support energy, increase muscle mass with strength training, and boost drive and performance in your romantic life. When I started taking Ageless Male, I started feeling great, faster than I thought possible. Ageless Male is what helps keep the Hulkster going. Imagine what it could do for you.
Try Ageless Male risk-free. Just call 1-800-495-3203. 1-800-495-3203.
Be the man you're meant to be and try Ageless Male right away.
Just call 1-800-495-3203. 1-800-495-3203.
Skype connections are encrypted from end to end. The problem that some people are having is that Microsoft recently bought Skype. And Microsoft has been implementing some architectural changes to Skype. And now people are thinking that Microsoft or perhaps Skype itself has the ability to intercept phone conversations on their own servers. In other words, they could set up a man-in-the-middle attack from their servers.
Stay up to date with technology. It's Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Federal News Radio, available on demand at federalnewsradio.com and on your smartphone with the free TuneIn Radio app.
federalnewsradio.com, your one-stop shop for all things federal. Listen daily to interviews with federal managers and government contractors. Read Mike Causey's daily federal report or just stop by for an update on the latest news affecting the federal community. federalnewsradio.com, your source for federal news now.
Here's Nancy Register, Associate Director, Consumer Federation of America, and Director of America Saves on the panel, The Perfect Score, supporting small businesses to achieve 100% adoption of direct deposit via ACH, sponsored by NACHA.
Our research shows that when employers talk to their employees about money, they listen. And so employers need to encourage their employees to save regularly, and direct deposit and a split deposit is one of the primary ways to do that.
To listen to the whole program made possible by NACHA, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Direct deposit via ACH is good business for every business, even if you're a small business. It's simple, safe, smart, and green. It's easy to set up and use. It's confidential and reduces fraud. It saves time and processing costs and helps protect the environment. So make the change now. Visit electronicpayments.org to learn how and see how easy it is to adopt direct deposit via ACH today. Visit electronicpayments.org today.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, I.B. Falkison, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Commissioner William Roberts, who's the National Commander of the Salvation Army, Brian Wynn, who's the President of the Electric Drive Transportation Association, Karen Trowbridge, President and CEO of Trowbridge and Trowbridge, and Dolly Oberai, the CEO of C Squared Technologies. First up is Commissioner William Roberts, who's the National Commander of the Salvation Army. Tell us a little bit about the Salvation Army in a way that we wouldn't normally know it.
Thank you, Peter. The Salvation Army has been in business for 150 years almost, serving the poor and the indigent, the marginalized in society, as a part of its Christian mission, an organization which lives out its faith by serving people.
And how old is this organization?
Began in London, England in 1865, came to the United States in 1880. Almost 150 years ago, we began.
Uh-huh. And how big or small is in terms of membership? And, I mean, how big are you guys, really?
A worldwide membership of over a million people. In the United States, a membership of members of about 85,000 with some 65,000 employees, but over 3 million people volunteer for the Salvation Army in some way or other throughout the year.
You were clearing up a commonly held misconception in the green room. Share it with us.
The Salvation Army is a Christian church. Many are unaware of that. We don't necessarily tout that, but we are a Christian church. We are a Christian church which tries to demonstrate its faith through practical deeds, active ministry, and service to those who are in need.
Right. And you are the national commander.
Yes, sir, I am.
And what does that entail exactly?
I coordinate the work of the Salvation Army in the United States of America. The Salvation Army is in every state in this country in some 6,500 communities. And our office coordinates what the Army is doing across this country.
How long have you been in the role?
Been in this role since November of 2010, so almost 2 years.
Why were you the ideal pick at this point in time to run the organization?
You'd have to ask somebody other than me, but I suspect it's because of my background, my commitment to the organization. I do believe the Salvation Army is doing the most good. I've had experience in a number of different arenas of the Salvation Army around the world, and all that together, I think, led my leaders to believe that this is where I should be.
And talk about the mandate you feel going forward. What is it that you'd like to accomplish in your time in this role?
Well, of course, we want to keep the Salvation Army vibrant and involved and relevant in today's society. What worked 150 years ago may not work this year. We want to make sure the Salvation Army stays true to its mission of serving God by serving people. And if we can do that, I think we will have accomplished something worthwhile.
Right. How long have you been involved in the organization?
Well, I've been in the Salvation Army all my life. I've been a Salvation Army officer for 40 years. So it's the only thing I've ever done, really, with my life.
And why was that a good decision, looking back on it?
Well, I think it's a good fit. I saw, like my parents, I saw them enjoying their work in the Salvation Army and thought if they were enjoying it so much and found it so worthwhile and rewarding, I might be able to do that as well.
So this is a two-generation thing. Your parents were involved.
That's right. They were involved and before I was born, and they still are as retired Salvation Army officers to this day.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you grow up?
Grew up primarily in Detroit, Michigan. Detroit's my home. Detroit's coming back. I love Detroit. Michigan's my home, but we've served around the world.
And so tell me about growing up in Detroit. What was that like as a young kid?
Well, we didn't sense nearly the kinds of issues and difficulties that are in Detroit now. It was a different day. People seemed to be able to appreciate each other and work with each other. It certainly had a decent infrastructure in the city in those days, and there was work to do. People had jobs.
And Mom and Dad, they were active in the Salvation Army for as long as you can remember.
They were active before I was born, and they're still active even in their inactive years of retirement, yes.
So what were you like as a kid?
Well, I was probably a normal kid. I didn't get into a great deal of difficulty or cause any problems, at least that I remember. And I fought with my sisters and didn't always do what my parents told me to do and sometimes got punished for it. I think I was just a regular kid.
What other important influences or events helped shape you looking back on it?
Well, certainly my parents had a great influence on me, but I can recall some early day for me, Salvation Army people who demonstrated by their own lives of integrity and honesty and faithfulness, that living this kind of life as a Salvation Army officer was rewarding, it was joyful, and it was meaningful. And I think their influence led me to find the same thing for my own life. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any particular mentors who you recall along the way who encouraged you to encourage this particular line of work?
Well, there were several. I remember especially a very elderly Salvation Army officer who is now no longer living, but who took an interest in me. Now, I had three sisters, and I sometimes felt a little isolated at home with all these girls. And he took an interest in me, sensed I might have had some awkwardness growing up, some difficulty, but he took an interest in me and would put his arm around my shoulders and take me to the ball game and do all those kinds of things, even at his advanced age. And I think his kind of influence and his, he was a grandfather kind of person, helped me, yeah.
So you've been involved in this for so long, and your parents have been involved. Mm-hmm. What has changed most across the years, looking back on it?
Well, the Salvation Army has become more automated, of course, along with society. We do a lot more things electronically. The danger in that is we may tend to stay in our offices and at our computers and not be out with the people. And there's a real danger in a Salvation Army officer leaving the streets and leaving the neighborhoods and staying in the office where it's safer, of course, but where it's easier to do business, I think, for many people.
That's interesting. So how do you blend technology and the human touch in the way that you deliver your services?
Well, it has to be intentional. I don't think we can just hope it happens or wait for it to happen, but I have to push myself at times to be with people. I am not an extrovert. I'm very introvertish. I have to push myself at times. Others may not believe that or think that, but I do enjoy being with people. I like to be with people. I like people. And so there's some intentionality about being sure I have a good mix of office work and neighborhood work, if you will, community work, and being with people. I think it's sort of like management by walking around is what I call it. So at our office, I spend time with people. I don't stay in my office all day.
Where did you learn how to lead?
I learned it in school. I learned it from watching other Salvation Army officers who seemed to me to be successful, to finding a meaning, and who were appreciated by others that they were leading. And I thought in a number of instances, if I could be like that, I'll try to be like that and copy that. And
so for a younger person listening in and might have an altruistic calling, why should they be thinking about you?
Well, I can testify that there is joy and fulfillment in serving people. I find a great deal of satisfaction in knowing I'm helping somebody in their moment of need or distress or despair, that there is hope. There's always hope, and hope is what keeps us going. And if I can help somebody to be hopeful in a day when many don't have any hope at all, I think that would be a major accomplishment.
What excites you most about the future?
I think the spirit of young people, especially in our organization, in the Salvation Army, young people are involved. They want to be involved in the community. They want to be involved in the church, in religion and faith. They want to be involved in doing good and making a difference. I think that gives me a great deal of hope for the years ahead.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is?
I think being asked to leave the United States and to serve around the world.
What did go ahead and get your warning. What did that experience teach you?
Well, first of all, it taught me there was a whole world outside the United States, that this isn't the whole world here in this country.
Uh-huh.
It taught me there were people outside this country who were worthy of my respect and my attention. And so we served in South America, in Argentina, we served in the UK, we served in Kenya, and I found people just like me. Well, they breathed and bled red blood, but who had aspirations and hopes and who had needs. And that helped me to have a greater appreciation for this world that God has created. He has created the whole thing.
Yeah. How about your proudest moment up till now?
Well, I take a great deal of pride in my children and my grandchildren, of course, who have done well, in my humble opinion, through little or any influence, I suspect, from me. But they have. I'm very proud of the way our children have turned out.
That's wonderful. What's the website address, William?
What's the website address?
Well, we can go out to the Google it if we need to, right?
It's there.
Great.
It's there.
We've been speaking with Commissioner William Roberts, who's the National Commander for the Salvation Army. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ivy Falconson, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies bringing you your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Jeff Poro.
And Jeff, who are you with?
I'm the head of Poro Associates, LLC.
And what is Poro Associates, LLC?
Well, I write speeches for corporate and nonprofit executives.
Oh, so you're a speechwriter?
Yes, I am.
Particular industries that you focus on?
No, I don't. I like to have a broad range of clients. It keeps me interested.
Do you also tend to write or just speeches?
I do other kinds of writing, but speeches are really my sweet spot.
Any particular topic?
I like them all. Recently, I've been doing a lot about corporate social responsibility and the environment, but that's just kind of who I'm working for now.
Is that more of a passion and focus of yours, or again, just who the clients you work with?
I would say it's more the clients. My passion really is to have a lot of different pieces of subject matter, and that's when I'm really happiest.
How did you get into this?
That's a good question. The short answer is I had been a general writer and kind of got a little bored with it and really thought about what kinds of writing really turns me on, and I realize that I'm most excited when I'm writing speeches.
So how do people find you? How do they know how to get in touch with you if they need help writing a speech for a performance or
Yeah, that's a very good question. The easiest way is I'm on the web, www.porollc.com. You can also find my columns in the Washington Business Journal. I write every month or two.
Oh, great. Do they put your picture in there too?
They do. Well, they do, and it's pretty flattering.
Well, we'll have to look for your picture. Again, this is Paul Smith bringing you your Business Spotlight. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ivy Falconson, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Brian Wynn, who's the president of the Electric Drive Transportation Association. What is the Electric Drive Transportation Association, Brian?
EDTA is a trade association, a cross-industry association, made up of automobile manufacturers, utility companies, battery manufacturers, charger manufacturers, all of the different industry segments that are bringing electric transportation to the marketplace. So it's basically an organization in Washington that's dedicated to bringing these new advanced technology vehicles to the market.
So it sounds like industries that don't normally associate with each other found a way to get together.
Well, that's what jumped out at me too when I first started getting interested in this. The world of emissions, the utility industries, you know, central emissions versus the auto industry, right, mobile emissions, they were working together to bring a technology to the marketplace that would actually help not only the environmental community help us reach our environmental goals, but also some exciting commercial goals and energy security goals as well.
Right. And the organization was founded when?
In 1989.
And how big or small is it today?
We're 110 members today and growing rapidly, and we have a staff of 10 in Washington.
And what would you say the primary purpose of the association is today?
It's really to ensure that industry and government are collaborating to bring this technology to the market and help really achieve our policy objectives in the environmental area, in the energy area, and in the transportation area. So this is an area where government plays a huge role, and technology is extremely important, and we can make great strides in all three of those directions with this technology.
So you're the president. When did you become president, Brian?
In April 2004.
Why did you want the job?
Because I'm really excited about the technology. It's anything that we can do to displace oil with electricity, which is domestically produced, makes a great deal of sense to me. And electric motors, many people don't realize, but electric motors used to be, at the very beginning, the propulsion drive of choice. So this is like back to the future in some respects, and I think what's different, of course, now is that we have much better batteries and we have much different ways of configuring this technology because there are lots of different kinds of vehicles in the fleet.
Right.
What is the biggest misconception about electric motors? Because there's a huge sociocultural inertia in this country.
Yeah.
We love oil. That's when Americans think of the energy of choice, it's oil.
Well, we love to drive. I agree with that.
Right.
I'm not sure that we're so wild about oil because, you know, it goes up, it goes down, it's wildly fluctuating price, and it's not so great for the environment. I think, to me, the biggest misconception is that these are golf carts. And nothing could be further from the truth. What you get with an electric motor is instantaneous torque. So if, you know, we have vehicles out there that'll do 0 to 60 in under 4 seconds. They're the fastest cars off the line. And, of course, that is not necessarily what we want to sell per se. But people get in these cars, they get in a car that's driven by an electric motor, they step on the accelerator, you go, and you're not making any noise. It's a completely different dynamic experience. And they say, wow, that's really cool. And they get what we call the EV smile. That's destroying this misperception that these are golf carts.
So why do you suppose what did the association see in you that made you the ideal pick?
I'm really passionate about technology in general, and I wasn't from any of these industries. I came at it from the standpoint of utilizing technology in transportation, and basically I'm very passionate about advancing what we need to do to get more diversity in our fuel structure. Said differently, we want some choice out there. I, as a consumer, want some choice. I think this is the best way to do it because electricity is not a resource. It's a form of energy, and it can be created with lots of different kinds of resources: coal, solar, wind, right, geothermal, natural gas. And that diversity, which of course is regional, is what's going to make this really, really compelling. And people forget, we get on a train in New York and we go all the way to Washington. There's no batteries on that train other than the buffer. That's electricity coming directly from the grid. So there are things that we can do with this particular technology. It's so flexible that we can't do with any of the other fuels.
Has technology always been fascinating to you, or is this relatively new?
It's always been fascinating to me, but I'm not an engineer, so I don't really understand a great deal of it. I'm really fascinated by what we can do with it. And I've been reading the Steve Jobs book and how he always came at it from the standpoint of what the consumer can do with something. I look at it from an end user perspective.
When did that fascination begin? Is this a childhood thing, or when did it start happening?
It's really hard to pin it down. I think it started to come out probably when I was traveling abroad in college, and I started to see people, they move themselves differently in other places around the world. They utilize the same kinds of technologies, but they do it somewhat differently. And part of that's cultural. Part of it's just the way their economies have developed. Part of it's policy. And so this particular thing caught my eye because it's a global phenomenon. It's a proven technology in terms of the propulsion capabilities, but it's also benefiting from massive advances in software and microprocessor speeds and things like that. So it all sort of came together, and it really captured my imagination.
Right. You said you had an interesting comment. Oil is distorting, and I forgot the rest of it in the green
room. All international relations.
Say a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, for starters, if you look at the way money flows when it comes to oil, it basically is being concentrated in places around the world that are not favorable to U.S. interests. That's a distortion, essentially. It's also not a free market phenomenon. We have a cartel, essentially, that controls production of oil to enough of an extent that we in this country will never be able to control the price of gasoline. It will go up, it will go down. If the price goes up, no matter how much we make here, it'll flow to a place where we can get a better price for it. That's what happens in economics. So I look at that and I say, what's better for us? And how can we as a country stop spending literally $1 billion a day on oil that's coming in from somewhere else?
So I listened to you describe this, and I'm trying to wonder, is it the technology that fascinates you and makes you so passionate about this or this mission? Are you a mission-driven guy?
Well, it's a mission-driven organization, and yeah, I guess that's why they hired me for, because I'm a mission-driven guy. I think there's a lot of leverage here, and did I mention how much fun the cars are to drive?
Okay, well, we'll have to try that after the show. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Vestal, New York, up near Binghamton.
Uh-huh. Mom and Dad, what were they doing growing up?
Dad was an IBMer, worked in Endicott, where IBM originated. Many people don't know that. Mom was basically a housewife, a frustrated musician who wanted a career for herself, uh-huh. And now is a great career musician.
Looking back on it, how do you think your parents shaped you, who you are today?
They very much encouraged me, more my mother than my father, but they very much encouraged me to pursue my international interests. I was always fascinated by what was going on and overseas. When it came time, it was for me to go explore that. I learned another language and did so. So they really encouraged me to do that.
Yeah. Brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have. I started out with four brothers and a sister. Well, I've lost one of my brothers, but we're very close.
What was it like? What were you like as a kid growing up?
I was always trying to be like my older brother. He was always doing stuff that I wanted to do, and so I was always pushing the envelope.
What'd you major in college?
I majored in history and economics.
And talk about your first job out of college.
My first job out of college was I didn't have a first job out of college per se, because I went right into overseas. I went back overseas to study on a fellowship, and then I came back and did my graduate work. So my first real job was working for the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Chuck Percy, senator from Illinois,
mm-hmm.
Who was a great man. He was really a very, very good senator and a fun man to work for.
So how long did you spend in the public? How long were you in the public sector, really?
Only about a year. Uh-huh. Only about a year, and I'm not sure people would call Capitol Hill the public sector.
Right.
sort of a place unto itself.
Where would you like to have this organization 5 years from now?
I'd like it to be a clear go-to organization for all the transportation experts in the world, a place where we can convene the best thinkers and look at how we build the next transportation system of the future, or the next transportation system. Yeah, the interstate highway system is a good example of a leader having a vision, namely President Eisenhower, of creating a system, a transportation system, upon which we would create and have created trillions of dollars in value. But that system was built for cheap gasoline, and much of our transportation systems today in metropolitan areas are built on sprawl and based on cheap gasoline. Gas is not cheap anymore. And there's a recognition that we need to move people and goods differently in this country, and I want to have this be one of the organizations where people figure that out.
Where do you think, what percentage of cars will be electric 5 years from now?
Oh, that's a really difficult question to say, but because the studies are notable only for their ranges. But
right.
But what I will say is that the technology utilized, we call electric drive, which can be configured as a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, a pure battery, or a fuel cell. That technology is going to be pervasive in the next 10 years.
What's the website address, Brian?
Our association website is electricdrive.org, and our consumer-facing website is goelectricdrive.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Brian Wynn, who's the president of the Electric Drive Transportation Association. I'd like to thank Ivy Falkison with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com. To learn more about our executive leaders, we'll be back in a moment after this business spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our clients' best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, Ivy Falkinson, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Karen Trowbridge, who's the president and CEO of Trowbridge & Trowbridge. What is Trowbridge & Trowbridge?
Trowbridge & Trowbridge is a professional service provider. We provide IT and telecommunications and unified communication services to defense and civilian federal customers.
Well, give us an example of exactly what type of service you would provide that's a telecommunication service.
Sure. On the telecom side, we provide the telephone systems to Army and Air Force installations across the country. We also, on the software side, provide a lot of software development, some cybersecurity, system engineering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the company's been around for how long, Karen?
Founded in 2006.
How big or small today?
We have about 285 employees currently and doing just under $30 million in revenue a year.
So that's pretty good, a lot of growth in just that short amount of time. Why start a company?
Good question. I had it in my mind from a pretty young age to one day start my own business. My father...
You had it in your mind at a pretty young age. How young were you when you realized I had to start a business?
Well, it evolved. I'll say this. Growing up, my father always instilled in us an entrepreneurial spirit. He said, be your own boss one day. Be your own boss one day. And in college, originally, I thought I wanted to go to med school. So I studied on that track for a while and then opened up my own practice. However, I realized I had a fear of blood and that that path went away. But after college, I had an opportunity to join his company, which was a government contractor in the IT space, and went through a very extensive leadership development program that they had just implemented that gave me an opportunity to rotate through the company, all the departments of the company, finance, business development, pricing, and learn the ins and outs of a business, which really gave me a foundation business period. And then the last part of that program was a rotation on their one of their contracts supporting the National Institutes of Health. And for me, that's really where the magic happened. I got to work on a specific project, which whose you know the mission of NIH is to improve human health, and such a neat mission, and you know work with the federal customers hand in hand every day. And that's when I knew, in terms of starting my own company, that I wanted to go into the same industry and work with different customers around the government.
So I bet you had the support of your father.
Yes.
What was so what happened? You went out and tried to start a company all on your own. Take us through the early days.
Sure. Well, actually, I'm very blessed. I was fortunate. I had a lot of good relationships that I was able to leverage and a lot of help along the way. There's no way we'd be at our size if it weren't for that. The contract that I was supporting when I started my company, the prime contractor, RSIS, then acquired by Wiley Information Systems, they gave me my first subcontract to get started. So in November of 2008, I hired my first five people. I was still on the project myself, billable for the early years, running the company on the side. And then in 2010, we were able to acquire a company based out of Oklahoma City, Altec Services. So we grew very rapidly overnight. It was a synergetic acquisition. I knew the owner of that company. And it was a partnership. So it's just been a lot of fortuitous events along the way that have allowed us to grow quickly.
Well, it's very unusual to have an acquisition without a surprise. What surprised you most when you acquired this company?
Well, you know, for us, I think the largest surprise was that this was a new line of business. This is how we got into the telecom space. I was very familiar with the IT side of the house. So it was learning the ins and outs of managing these types of contracts and learning about these new customers. There's also, you know, a lot of challenges with any acquisition, no matter how smoothly it goes, in terms of merging corporate cultures and realigning the management team. I think we did it pretty well.
How old were you when that occurred?
I was 28. Yeah.
So how did you ever find that you were not taken seriously somewhere along the way?
Yes, I have encountered that. I think that's probably one of my challenges. I think I have a young face, too, so that is another setback. And it just means that I need to continue to prove myself. And luckily, I've got, you know, a really strong team of folks around me who are dedicated to the company. And
so if you go about setting to prove yourself, what does that look like? What are you doing to inspire trust and confidence?
Well, from a leadership perspective,
yeah.
You know, it's about, first of all, believing in a mission, believing in what you're doing, and then setting the parameters in terms of who you're all about. And so for me, my biggest things are integrity, trust, and respect. And so all of the folks that have joined the company embrace those same goals. And I've noticed that if I just carry myself in that regard, and that is who I'm all about, that ultimately that will inspire trust and respect in others.
So here we are today. You've grown all this and you've done well. Where do you want to be 5 to 10 years from now?
We have an aggressive growth strategy. I'm looking to grow. There are a lot of small businesses out there that are niche players, but that's not our approach. Ultimately, in 5 to 10 years, I'd like to be at least $200 million. The market has changed quite a bit from the early days, so I'm not sure if that's quite as viable, but that's certainly our vision.
How do you plan to deal with all the uncertainty facing government contractors?
Well, one of the things that we are very good at, and I think this will ultimately help us get there, is that we're adaptable. We're a small business, and as a small business, we're able to do a lot. But because we can quickly adapt and respond to the changing needs of our customers, to the changing procurement market that we're facing today, I think that will allow us to continue to be creative and go after new business and think through new ways of doing things to ultimately support our customers and grow the company.
Mm-hmm. I want to step back because I can't let this go. You thought about medical school, and now you're an entrepreneur, and I know that I talk to folks every day who say, you know, I think I need to be a doctor or I need to be a lawyer. That's what my parents want to be, but it's just not the gig for them. What would you say to a wannabe or a would-be entrepreneur to encourage them to sort of take the leap?
That's a great question. And I'll tell you, the reason I wanted to go to medical school is back in the day was because I thought it was a guaranteed job, and that was attractive to me. I could control my own destiny in my own field, but if you go to medical school, you go to law school, you've got a guaranteed career, and that was certainly appealing. And we know now that that's changed. I have a number of friends, especially in the legal position, where that's not the case. So I would say to anyone who is looking to explore an entrepreneurial career path, first and foremost, you have to be willing to take risks, and you have to be willing to leverage everything that you have, every skill that you have, every talent that you have. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there. Use your relationships, and you don't have to pull the plug all at once, because a lot of these folks have student loans that they're, you know, trying to pay off. But you've got to be willing to take that leap and explore all possible methods to do it.
So talk about this willingness to take risk. Did you learn that sitting around the family table? This is just in the family? Or where did you decide that I'm going to do it?
The stars aligned for me quite a bit, you know, as I was explaining my story in terms of the timing to start the company. But from a risk-taking approach, I tend to think that you're born with it. But that being said, it's a learned skill too. It just requires stepping out of your comfort zone a bit. And, you know, if you're not as comfortable taking risks, establishing whatever parameters that you need to take a small risk and then hopefully see payoff. But that's ultimately the only way you'll be able to, see larger successes.
So talk to me about your leadership style. You went through this training program. How would you characterize your leadership style?
Well, one of the benefits of that training program was that I had the opportunity to work under a number of very talented leaders over at that company. So I got to see a lot of different approaches, things that worked for others, and learn what works for me. For me, it's all about trust, finding the right people for my team who share my vision, and also complement my own style, which is really setting parameters, setting goals and objectives, setting a vision, making sure that they've got the resources and tools they need, and then holding them accountable and rewarding success. Ultimately, I can get my hands dirty. I like to do that as a small business. It's basically a requirement. But I really like to put a lot of trust and faith in my folks to do what they need to do. And that seems to be a pretty good recipe for success in our management team right now.
You've talked about the importance of your father's influence on your life. How about your mom?
Oh, my mom played a huge, huge role in terms of who I am today. She's an extremely positive person, just a wonderful-hearted individual, and probably my biggest cheerleader growing up.
What other, looking back on it, mentors or events helped shape who you are today?
Oh, I had so many great mentors along the way. On the business side, a couple of folks in particular over at RSIS who really not only taught me about, you know, what goes into running a business, but how to deal with people. I had some great mentors when I was working on site for the customer at NIH, a lot of senior leaders over there. One of the greatest lessons I learned was a leader over there who asked me, Karen, what's been the greatest lesson you've learned since you've been here? And I kind of expected where he was going with this. And I answered, it's really, it's about the people. It's about relationships. And so, you know, for me, and in any industry, and certainly in this one, it's relationship building, working with people.
Is your father surprised at your success?
I'm not sure he would be surprised at it.
If I was interviewing him, what would he say about you?
Well, he's very funny. I think he's proud of me. He tells me that quite a bit. But he also, one of his greatest strengths as a parent is he always keeps his kids humble. And we're never allowed to get egos that are too big.
What's the website address, Karen?
It's www.tt-llc.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Karen Trowbridge, who's the president and CEO of Trowbridge & Trowbridge. I'd like to thank Ivy Falkinson with the law firm of Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies bringing you your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Tony Cancelosi from the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind.
And Tony, what brings you here today?
Well, we're here today to talk about our Light the Way 5K race at National Stadium on September 29th, which is a Saturday, and to talk about why we're having this 5K race. It's for veterans, visually impaired and blind veterans, also individuals who are visually impaired and blind. But the unique thing about this race, it's chaired by Mark Lerner, one of the principal owners of the Nationals, and Steve Niergall, the regional president of Safeway. The interesting part is that this is the first sanctioned 5K race by the waterfront. Be very exciting for runners who want to be timed and win a prize. But also it's a walk fun race for individuals and families. But also the unique thing about this race is that you have the opportunity to guide someone who's visually impaired and blind in the race.
So if I understand that, then you can be visually impaired and still do this race. This is not for just people that can see and run.
Absolutely. And the opportunity to guide somebody is a very unique experience. The best part about this race is the sponsors. We have some great sponsors, naturally the Nationals, Safeway. We have a very unique opportunity for you to come out and enjoy lots of food. It's catered by Geppetto's Caterer Barbecue. We have Utz Potato Chips. We have Coca-Cola. We have Nestle's Chocolate.
Oh, sounds like a great place.
Oh, it's fantastic.
How do people find out more about this? How do they contact you?
All you have to do is go to register online, wwclb.org.
www.clb.org. And there's registration there for the 5K walk race. That's great. This is Paul from Potomac Companies, and this has been your Business Spotlight. Thank you.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by I.B. Falkison, who's with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Dolly Oberai, who's the CEO of C-Square Technologies. What is C-Square Technologies, Dolly?
C-Square Technologies is a defense and government contractor specializing in e-learning, training, and human capital management.
Say a little bit more about e-learning. What does that mean?
Well, we focus on improving human performance through training. So, for example, we do a lot of training for the United States Air Force air crews. So we train them on different aircrafts like the B-1s, B-52s. We get them mission ready. And now we are also getting pilots ready for unmanned aircrafts. So that's just an example of what type of training we do.
And when was the company founded?
In 1989.
And how big or small are you today?
Today we are 400 strong and $60 million in revenue.
So why start a company?
Well, it's the most exciting thing to do. Well, I graduated from college in a very innovative, got a very innovative degree and didn't know what to do with it. So I tried to work for a couple of defense contractors in the Washington, D.C. area, and then it wasn't going so well, so I decided to start my own company and leveraging my innovative technologies.
And the initial vision was born out of your research from Harvard University. Is that correct?
Correct.
So take us back a little bit to how all this got started.
Well, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family in New Delhi, and I worked, after graduating from college, I worked briefly for my mother, who has an education trust with several K-12 schools. And when I worked for her, I realized that the students that we were catering to were the first generation of learners, and they had really never left their little homes, their little shacks that they were growing up in, and didn't know anything about the world. So I thought we could bridge the gap between them and the world through technology. So I left home as a tourist and traveled the world in search of technology.
How old were you when you did that?
I was 25.
And you came to the United States?
I came to the United States, and I traveled around the country and visited many colleges in search of computers.
Uh-huh. So that you could bring technology back to your mother's business?
That's correct.
And you happened to find yourself one day at MIT. And then what happened?
So I went and attended a demonstration. There was a little demonstration of how to use computers in education. Totally fascinated me, and that was exactly what I was looking to take back to India. And so I decided to apply to school. It was a program. The Media Lab was doing a lot of innovations in education technology, and Harvard was offering actually a degree program. So I applied to the Harvard program, and the rest is history.
Well, it wasn't that simple. I understand it was a little tough to get in.
It was a little tough to get in. I did not have all the credentials and the capabilities at that time. For example, you needed to take the test for English language and GRE and so on and so forth. And I had come with $200 in a backpack, and I couldn't quite have the money to pay for those tests. So I had to go and petition to the admissions officers and persisted till they got sick of me and asked me to go and talk to the dean and make my case. And I did. I articulated my vision that I wanted to bring the globe to my schools in New Delhi through technology. And so that's how I got accepted.
You said that you articulated your vision, and I love that. I mean, can you just expand on the importance of having a clear vision as an entrepreneur?
You know, sometimes people think that things happen by accident. Actually, they don't. When you have an idea, you have to make sure that your idea can then be implemented. And those ideas are born. Then at that point, you have to have a vision on how you're going to take it from idea to implementation. So articulating that vision and then implementing is actually the key, because there are a lot of ideas, but entrepreneurs are not enough in this world.
Yeah, but the 495 is littered with people who had great ideas and never acted on them.
Correct.
What is it about you that so compelled you to come to this country with $200 in a backpack, convince MIT to accept you on a vision? What's going on there?
Well, I think I was really excited about a technology and how we could use technology to educate especially the kind of client base that we were catering to, that I was going to do whatever it took.
When did the light go off for you, though? Because the way I understand it, there wasn't a lot of technology in India at the time. Where didn't you realize that, A, technology existed, and B, there's a place for it here?
First of all, I taught, as I mentioned, I taught the first generation of learners. They had no exposure to anything. I used to teach them social studies and geography. I would talk, I would show them the map, and they didn't know what that meant. So that's when the light went off, what if we connected them through satellites? We connected the kids in Japan and Africa with the kids in New Delhi, and they learned from each other about their different cultures and countries. That's when the light went off, and I said, okay, there must be a way to do this. Maybe it's computers, maybe it's satellite-based education.
And so you just decided to go on a nice personal journey for a long time and figure it out?
Yes.
Tell us about your mother. I understand that she owned a business at a time when women don't normally do that.
Correct. So my mother moved from Pakistan to India in 1947 during the time of partition. She was totally homeless and came as a refugee. And when she got her college degree, and moved to New Delhi, she realized that there were a lot of refugee developments coming up, but there were no schools. So she started establishing elementary schools to cater to that first generation of learners. And that was very inspirational for all of us. I worked with her very closely through the developmental phases of her schools. And then, of course, when I graduated from college, I worked there. So that's what really inspired me.
But that's such an uncommon thing. What was that like for you growing up?
It was both good and bad. Bad because everybody felt sorry for us as kids, because they felt that we were motherless, and good because she engaged us fully in her venture, and we learned so much at a young age, which made us very independent, which made us very focused on education and having professions as we grew up.
Right. And you said your father was supportive of all this, which
Absolutely.
Is also unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual. If it weren't for my dad, I don't think my mother would have a business, and none of my two sisters and I would be professionals either.
Are your sisters entrepreneurs as well?
Yes. My younger sister actually runs our trust, and my older sister decided to go into public service. She did run a school, and then she went into public service.
So why not go back to India and start a business there? Why stay here?
At the time, there was no option, because India, everybody said it was too early. We were not able to adopt technology at the time in 1986. However, now is the time, and yes, we are contemplating starting a university and an online campus and so on and so forth. The time is right now. Everybody's ready, and technology is there.
So you start the business back in 1989. You don't have a business degree, do you?
I don't.
Okay, so how'd you learn how to run a business?
On my own. One step at a time. You sound like my dad. He said I needed an MBA. You know, one of the things that I learned was that when you have a vision and you have an idea, you've got to implement it. So I just started consulting for my customers, and they were very pleased with what I was doing. And then they are the ones who inspired me to start producing solutions. They said, you can't just keep doing research studies for us and tell us how great technology is. You've got to actually produce solutions. That's when I realized that now I need a real company with capital, with access to market, employees, and so on and so forth. So I bootstrapped initially and then got some help from SBA for an initial business loan to get it all started.
Where did you learn how to lead?
I think one of the things that, as I mentioned, is that I was raised by leaders. Both my parents are entrepreneurs, and they were my role models. They led from their heads, their hearts, their hands, and their feet. And that was really something that they inspired me to do.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
I think the toughest thing that I've accomplished is taking the business from zero to $60 million. I think that is really, really hard. As an immigrant, especially in 1986, when being an Indian was not in style, people were more concerned about my ethnicity rather than my capabilities. It was extremely difficult to get anything started or obtain projects or capital or access to market.
How do you stay optimistic as an entrepreneur? Because there are so many challenges, and what people don't talk about are the risks and the risk for failure and uncertainty. How do you stay optimistic?
Actually, you know, one of the characteristics of an entrepreneur is optimism. If you're not positive and you're not optimistic, you're not going to be successful. So when I launch into, say, even a new area of practice, my gut tells me, this is going to work, and if it doesn't work, never mind. You know, you'll still get up and start running again. So I think the key is not to be scared. When you're overcautious and you're scared, you can never really succeed. So I launch into things and make sure that we give it the best shot possible, and then if it's successful, great. If it's not, we rebuild.
Where do you want to be 10 years from now?
10 years from now, I hope that we'll have our university in New Delhi.
If I was interviewing your mom, would she be surprised at your success?
I think she would be only surprised only because I grew up as a very quiet child, and she never knew, both my parents never really knew who I was, and I didn't know who I was till I came to the United States either.
Mm-hmm. How about your proudest moment up till now, Dalia?
That's a hard question. I think the proudest moment for me at this moment in time is that our son wants to be an entrepreneur. He's an idea guy. I think that's a great place to be at as a mom and as a business owner.
Wonderful. What's the website address for C-Square Technologies?
It's www.c2ti.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dalia Oberoi, who's the CEO of C-Square Technologies. I'd like to thank I.B. Falkerson with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interviews today. And we've had a great show, including Commissioner William Roberts, who's the National Commander of the Salvation Army, Brian Wen, who's the President of the Electric Drive Transportation Association, Karen Trowbridge, President and CEO of Trowbridge and Trowbridge, and finally, Dalia Oberoi, who's the CEO of C-Square Technologies. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This has been Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal
paid
news
commercial now.
May not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements.